Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hey, what is going on out there, everybody? You're listening to Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hell, and as always, sitting across the table from me, it's mi amigo, Mr. Kyle Filson.
Hello, everybody. How are you doing today? Today on the show, we're going to do, are your fingers truly unique? Do Bigfoots build nests? Does the lineage of giants still exist? The green-skinned children who appeared in an English village? A tower that pulls drinking water out of thin air? The Minnesota Iceman, and an alien that was shot at Fort Dix. How are you doing today?
I'm doing awesome, and an alien being shot at Fort Penis really just blows me away, man.
Yeah, this happened January 18th, 1978.
Woo-hoo-hoo, I can't wait to get onto it. Folks, if you haven't noticed, we've changed it up a little bit. We've had a few people send us messages and things saying that they would really like to know at the start of the show what we're getting into. That's what we're going to give you. We're going to give you our lineup. It helps out everybody.
We always
have
the lineup. We just never really read it for anybody. Yeah, so I can totally understand that. You don't really know what we're going to talk about until we start. I mean, everything doesn't need to be a mystery.
Yeah. So like I said, hey, we're taking it as we go, and we're trying to get it all worked out to where it all falls into place. You give us probably, folks, stick around with us, really bear with us, probably 10 or 15 years, we'll probably get this down, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're doing too bad for only doing it for like a little over 6 months.
But yeah, maybe. Yeah.
We're still ironing out the way we want to do it.
Yeah, I would say give me till the 20-year mark. In 20 years, I'll probably have it figured out, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
That's a big debate. Brett, how you been?
I mean, good, man. We just had off a two-week period with Easter and also a bye week. So yesterday was our first baseball game like in 2.5 weeks. So.
And the boys.
And we won. Yep.
Yep. The boys
and
put
the
it
team
on
that we were tied with lost yesterday. So we are officially in first place.
Ooh, nice.
Yep.
Nice. I love it. The boys. I don't understand. I wish everybody could be just so carefree when it comes to any kind. I mean, it's win or lose. The minute the game's over, they don't care. As long as they get like a snow cone or a little kind of treat, they're just woohoo.
No,
you don't see a Major League Baseball player doing that.
I don't think they even realize when they're winning or if they're losing. They like just completely oblivious to it.
Yes. It's funny because you would think, because I mean, how many times have you said the game that they lost, they thought they were winning?
Yeah. They're like, oh, we're totally beasting this team. I'm like, no, you guys are actually losing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I told you that Jacob was sitting in the dugout, and he was sitting up on top talking to his friends that they were really winning in the game I was at. I mean, they were destroying the other team, and he looked at his buddies. He goes, yeah, we're beasting these kids. And I was like, what?
Yeah, they're 6 years old, so it's pretty funny.
It is great. Well, yeah, let's get into a little fun. Let's have a little crazy article time.
Do you think that your fingerprints are truly unique? See, I always thought that they were.
I always 100% thought that my fingerprints was 100%. I'm the only one with these fingerprints.
Well, that's what I thought. But according to unexplainedmysteries.com, there's a new article in there. And it says, according to home office expert Mike Silverman, the process of using fingerprints as a computer database to identify someone at a crime scene is fundamentally flawed.
You're kidding me.
No, it says, you know, despite fingerprint evidence or the way it's portrayed in the media and on TV, that all comparisons ultimately involve some human element. And as a result, they are vulnerable to human error, he said. And although it's very rare, almost like as rare as, I guess, winning the lottery, the odds of winning the lottery,
mm-hmm.
but it is possible that your fingerprints could match somebody else's?
Ooh, I wonder if that's, surely that's, I wonder if that's ever happened though in the past where someone's actually been found guilty of a crime.
Well, I don't know. It says there's no particular, no conclusive evidence to support the idea that it's impossible for two different people to share a matching fingerprint. They don't rule it out. I mean, it could be that you would have a close enough match.
Oh, that's crazy.
I was wondering, you know, and it made me think, I mean, like we were just speaking of my boys playing baseball. They are identical twins.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how similar their fingerprints are.
And also, too, I wonder how close their DNA is to where if one did something DNA-wise, they couldn't tell them apart, too.
Man, I don't know.
That's something that I'm just going to say as a friend that coming from those two boys, you might want to look into. Because you're going to definitely pay for everything you've done.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Silverman, a veteran fingerprinting technology veteran, having introduced the first automated fingerprint detection system to the Metropolitan Police, it says here he believes that a combination of false positives, partial prints, and human error can make the fingerprint identification process very unreliable. You know, and I've never, I mean, I've always thought that that was ironclad. You know, if they have your fingerprints, you're done. I guess it has been treated that way, but now it's starting to come out that it may not be that way. So I wonder how many people have been incarcerated.
Yeah.
I think what they're trying to say with the article is it is 99.9% reliable, but there is an off chance that it could be somewhere on planet Earth, there could be a match to your finger.
But in reality, I mean, just about everything that they do seems like there could be human error involved.
Of course.
You know?
Of course.
It seems like this is some other way of casting doubt on something that where they have this article and maybe many more like it, though, where a defense attorney can be like, okay, you know, here it is. There's no way that this guy did it.
Yeah, that's what I think it is.
Okay, Brud, that was the whole fingerprint thing, man. I just, I don't know. There's just so, I guess I still think it's there to create doubt. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's what it's for. Hey, did you see, there was a really cool story about some green children found in the 12th century?
Yeah, I did see that. In England, right?
They're in England, yeah. If you go to beforeitsnews.com, they're called the green-skinned children who appeared in an English village. It's actually from Woolpit, which is in Suffolk, England, is actually where it's at. And it's apparently from the 12th century. Now, we have a bunch of listeners, and they may be over there, so they may be able to tell us more if it's, you know, a legit story and the people from the locals in that area. But it was really cool because what it says that they have happened was that they actually found them in a hole in the ground that they used to trap wolves. And it was a boy and a girl, and they were both green in color.
Really?
Yeah, and that they took them back, I guess, to one of them's home. Let's see. Yeah, to the home of Richard DeCane, said a knight living in Wilkes, and where they said they refused to eat at all until they were actually given beanstalks. And when they were handed the beanstalks, that they would both eat, but that the boy ended up dying anyway. But that the little girl lived, and they said gradually adjusted to her new life, and extended the range of foods that she would eat, and that she lived a reasonably normal life and learned to speak English, but was described, this is what's funny, as being rather loose and wanton in her conduct. I guess she's kind of like a wild gal, you know? Maybe she liked to go out and have a few drinks and dance. I don't really know what the loose and wanton.
Yeah, what does that
mean?
She's
a free spirit, I guess.
I guess.
I think I went to school with a bunch of girls like that.
is that what they're hinting at, or are they just talking about she? I mean, are they referring to her as she grew up?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They're talking as she grew up. But here's the really cool thing is there was a man that actually, an English Chronicle, recorded her explanation of where she came from. Everybody wanted to know, you know, what the heck? And this is what she said. Now,
and they were green.
They were green in color. And they don't say how green, but they were green.
Yeah, I saw the headline of the article in the Noteworthy News. I didn't get into the whole
The funny
article.
Thing to me is this. When you listen to this, this is allegedly, this is what she said. This is what Ralph DeCogshill actually recorded this. Like he said, was an English chronicler, and he questioned her, wanted to know, you know, the history of where she came from. Now, this sounds a lot like his embellishment, because I can't imagine a girl that learned English to be able to speak it this well whenever you hear this story. But basically, it says, being frequently asked about the people of her country, she asserted that the inhabitants and all they had in that country were of green color, and that they saw no sun but enjoyed a degree of light like what it is after sunset. being, or I guess probably right at sunset, but this is still what it says. But it says, being asked how she came into this country with the aforesaid boy, she replied that as they were following their flocks, they came to a cavern, on entering which they heard a delightful sound of bells. Ravished by whose sweetness, they went for a long time wandering on through the cavern until they came to its mouth. When they came out of it, they were struck senseless by the excessive light of the sun and the unusual temperature of the air, and they thus lay for a long time, being terrified by the noise of those who came on them. They wished to fly, but they could not find the entrance of the cavern before they were caught. And that's what she says is where they came from. Now.
So they went into a cavern somewhere, and when they came out, they were here.
Well, what she's saying is, yeah, that they were somewhere else, went into a cavern for upon hearing noise, and,
right,
bells. And when they came out, they were here. Now, there's a lot of people are saying that it's, I say a lot of people, through history, that maybe it's a parallel dimension.
Right.
Maybe, I mean, there's some crazy stories. Here's something, though, that's a little strange. In my opinion, it's funny. It says there's another tale of green children being found. This time it was in Spain.
Oh, so this has happened more than once.
Well, wait till I read you this little outtake of this story. It's from Banos, Spain, in August of 1887. A boy and a girl of greenish color were found abandoned near a cave. They did not speak Spanish and wore unfamiliar clothing. Their eyes were described as oriental in appearance. Both children refused to eat at first. The boy grew weak and died, but the girl survived, learned Spanish, and explained that she and her companion came from a sunless land. The girl is reported to have claimed that they have been caught up in a whirlwind and found themselves in the cave. The girl died in 1892. Why does that sound so much like one
like
from
the other
12th?
Story?
Exactly.
Exactly the same. Sunless sky.
The only explanation is this.
They're green.
The story in Spain is bullcrap, that it's just an old wives' tale that's passed on from someone that heard the story.
From the 12th century.
From the 12th century.
Yeah.
Or it's history repeating itself. That's the only two things it can be.
Reminds me of that the blue guy. Have you ever seen the guy that turned blue?
Yes, I did see that.
He took some kind of silver.
Yes.
Man, I don't know what it was. Some kind of silver nitrate or something. I don't even remember why. But it, like, I mean, he looks like Papa Smurf. And he's going to be that way the rest of his life.
Now, Wikipedia, of course, being the fountain of knowledge they are, they have a little bit more of a plain explanation of this whole thing. And it even says in the article, they give a rather mundane explanation. And it says this: many Flemish immigrants arrived in eastern England during the 12th century, and they were persecuted after Henry II became king in 1154. A large number of them were killed near Bury St. Edmunds in 1173 at the Battle of Farnham, fought between Henry II and Robert de Beaumont, 3rd Earl of Leicester. Paul Harris has suggested that the green children's Flemish parents perished during a period of civil strife, and that the children may have come from the village of Forham St. Martin, slightly to the north of Bury St. Edmunds, where a settlement of Flemish fullers existed at the time. They may have fled and ultimately wandered to Woolpit. Disoriented, bewildered, and dressed in unfamiliar Flemish clothes, the children would have presented a very strange spectacle to the Woolpit villagers. The children's color could be explained by green sickness, the result of a dietary deficiency.
I gotcha.
So
they're not like green, like Kermit the Frog green.
Well, that's
like a green.
It doesn't really tell you the tint. Yeah, because the minute I hear like the green children, I'm with you. As I'm like, alien green.
Like the blue guy, the guy that's blue. He is blue.
He's blue. Yeah.
He is as dark blue as a Smurf.
Yeah, but you know what? I was with you as I'm thinking green. Like, oh man, these kids are green. But it may be a little bit like that jaundice. You know, you hear, you know, you've seen
a bunch
a baby
of carrots,
with jaundice.
You'll start turning a little orange.
Yeah,
you know?
You're just kind of like, okay, is it just a hint of green? Because I'm thinking with you, like, this is Kermit the Frog green, man. So anyway, it's a pretty neat little story that I was like, oh, that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Did you see on the cryptozoology news, a guy by the name of the Squatch Master just released a new video, and it's on YouTube as well, and he's showing that do Bigfoots actually build nests?
Hmm.
And he's got a bunch of pictures. I think it's like four or five pictures on there. And he shows this, what he believes is a Sasquatch nest. It's got interwoven branches, piles of leaves, tree bark laying around, you know, like bedding material. Mm-hmm. And he claims that, that's what these things create, and that these, you can go out in the woods and you can find these structures. And when you see them, these are created by Sasquatch. Now, according to a researcher by the name of Roland Enos of the University of Manchester, great apes like orangutans and, and gorillas, they actually are known to build nests.
I know the mountain gorillas are known to nest, nest on the ground.
So it's not an uncommon trait amongst the greater apes. It says they know how the, wood's going to break. They have a feel for how strong the nest needs to be made, and they have the intelligence to make it almost like a crude human being would make a shelter. And hypothetically, if these cryptids actually do exist, they believe that they probably prefer the safety of a cave over these. But when there's no cave around, they'll build this nest to keep them away from insects and other predators, you know, or something like that. And also, it says that they only use them like one time and then they move on. So this feeds into the theory of them being a nomadic tribe, or, you know, how they move around from place to place. You know, here's the thing. I don't know that that's true. This guy could make that nest, then come back and take a picture of it. I hate to be the one that's always like trying to bust people's chops. You know, last week I was busting the audio, and now this guy's nest video. I'm not trying to do that. But to me, I mean, that's just not enough proof for me to see a structure made. Well, oh, Sasquatch made that. And even on the Lou Les Stroud show, what was the name of that? Survivor Man special or whatever. But they were showing that Todd guy, what's his last name?
Todd Standing.
Standing, yeah. I was thinking Todd Sees, the alien guy. Todd Standing it showed all these interwoven branches and stuff. And he's saying that those, now these weren't nests, but those were markers. Like this is a territorial marker. And see how these are on this path and they're pointing towards me. That means don't come in this area. And then the other ones are more welcoming. Is this stuff, is it really made by something natural? Or is this just happen to be a tree fell down, and a bunch of trees fell on it from a windstorm, a snow-bearing load, and it kind of looks like somebody made a nest. But is that really what it is? Or are these people manufacturing these and then taking pictures and claiming, look, I found this, you know? I don't know.
Well, I agree with you. It could be both. You know, I guess it could be the
It could be real.
That, yeah, and it,
I mean,
could
absolutely
be real.
Could be
right.
Real.
Yeah. I would like to see one.
Me too. That's...
I would like to be able, I would like to, you know, to find one, to see something where I could visually, like everybody else, I want to witness this alleged nest or this alleged, these limbs, to where there's places that you've been that you know there's nobody else. You know there's nobody else out in these woods and all that stuff. But also, too, you've built lean-to shelters and things when you've gone camping and messing around. And if you left them there for 6-8 months or so and somebody stumbled upon them, then it would look like something built it.
Well, something did build it, but how do you know that wasn't a human being
that
built that?
That's what I'm getting at is I don't.
Man, I mean, if it was a cold night and it was a little misty out or something, and I was in the woods and I didn't have a tent, you know, me and you've been rough backpacking several times, I would make a structure. I'd much rather sleep inside of a structure than just sleep out on the flat ground. Maybe that's all it is.
Well, and also, too, to argue the point that it is real, is I'm assuming that the great apes build it to save themselves from predators.
That's exactly right.
The problem in North America is, what's the only predator that a great ape's going to, or that a great ape of that size is going to have a problem with? Mountain lions, maybe?
A grizzly bear? But, you know, we've also heard stories of them just destroying pigs, feral hogs, like no problem.
Yes.
So to me,
I don't know. It's a really, like I said, I would like to see one. I would like to see what, my thing is this. Okay. Is there not hair? Is there not some sort of, if you could find one fresh, you should be able to find some sort of DNA on the branches, you would think, wouldn't you?
Well, in other, I mean, there's a Jack Lynx wrapper inside of it, and they had a straw pillow, so they know it had to be Sasquatch. Yeah. Now, I don't know.
Yeah, if you're using your bare hands, you're going to leave something on there, I would think.
Well, I know on the Les Stroud show, because I did watch it, both parts, some of those trees, you could tell, were very large, and I don't think a human being would be able to do that with their bare hands.
To snap them off, yeah.
Yeah, there's no way. But...
And some of those, you also, too, you see where they're snapped off are quite a ways up there.
Yeah, no, I know. That is interesting. Yeah, I'm still not saying that couldn't be snow, load, wind.
But you know what?
But I'm not ruling it out either, because some of that stuff is interwoven. You could, it almost looks like it.
You and I have been hunting on places before and seen these, and I've talked to a few people, too, that have seen these. Is you've been hunting on areas where there's a lot of blue-stem grass, big fields of blue-stem grass. And folks, of those that don't know, we're talking about, you know, almost like straw, but it's probably 3.5 foot tall, to 4 foot. You know, it can get taller, but bluestem's big, thick, and it's clumps, almost like the way monkey grass grows in clumps. Bluestem grows together, and there'll be fields of it here in Texas, and it's real rough to walk through, and that's where a lot of animals hide, a lot of whitetail bed down in it and the whole thing. And we've been on places hunting where there's no cattle, there's no horses, but out in the middle of that bluestem grass is big bedding areas.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't mean just like a bunch of small ones for whitetail. You can see those. But, I mean, I've seen some that are single bedding areas that are very large, larger than a whitetail doe and her fawn or even two fawns, larger than any where it looks like something very, very large has laid in that bluestem grass.
Yeah, and I don't know what it is.
I don't know. I have no idea. Now, I can speculate. I can assume. But
what would you speculate it is?
You would have to speculate that it is a large primate that's laying around out there, because there's nothing else that's that big that's going to be running wild, unless there's a horse loose or a cow loose or an elk loose.
I guess that's where my mind would go. Is I would not immediately assume it's a Sasquatch. I would be like, you know, I don't know what it is, but I don't know.
But if you spend, I mean, and I'm talking about not just like a weekend hunt. I'm talking about spending all year on a deer lease. There's no horses or cattle. There's nothing on it. There's nothing of that size, yet you find these things on there. Looking back at it now is when I'm kind of like, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've never found structure. I know people that have. We've got some good friends of ours that have found structures that have been built. We've also got good friends of ours that have found trees snapped off 8-9 foot up.
Yep.
Tops snapped I've seen out that. Of them.
I personally have never seen I've a never. Structure. I've never seen a tree snapped off. But also, as far as the structure in a tree, I don't know that I would really – looking for something like that. So I might have walked right by and just, yeah, it's just some brush piled up or, oh, it's a broke tree. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I could see how that could happen numerous times. I'm not in the woods looking for snap trees.
Yeah.
I'm tracking or looking for whitetail or something.
Or places to set up to hunt. Yeah. And the same Although thing.
I'm probably going to start paying a little more attention now that I know about it. Every time I read one of these things, I get
a little bit more. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, mm-hmm. I think of the places I hunted on a ranch. 3,800 acres. That was rough. I mean, that was probably 2/3 of it. You had to walk. You couldn't get mm-hmm. anywhere else on it. And, you know, we heard some strange things while we were out there. But I never once thought of that. It never once dawned on me instantly to go, oh, it's Sasquatch.
I'm glad it didn't, because I sleep by myself at night a lot when I used to hunt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if I'd be so comfortable doing
that. Or you wait till it's so dark that you can. I mean, it's from any bow hunter or anything like that. You're always the thing is you try to set till way after dark so you get down without anything seeing. You don't want anything to ever, you know, bust you going up into your
hide. You can as
your
much as possible. Or, that's yes. right. That's what's saying. Vice versa in the morning. You want to get in there well
way before
light.
Daylight. Yeah. So it makes you start thinking because, I mean, I know now sitting there and like you said too, knowing some of the stories that we've talked to people off air about and that we've had emailed us. And things that you're like, makes you start really thinking. You're like, I think I'll get down about 20 minutes before dark. I'm going to go ahead and make my way out of here because I don't want to.
When you're just using a bow. I mean,
a sharp
when it's really dark out and all you got is a bow, yeah, you're like,
You're in trouble, baby. That's all I'm saying is you're in trouble, baby.
That's when you stand on the string,
yeah.
Draw the bow to full and put the broadhead in your mouth and jump
and then
off.
Just step your toes off the string.
Yeah.
Just drive it through the top of your head. You don't want nothing to get you. Yeah. I mean, it really is. I don't know, but I would really like to. We'll put links to that
yeah,
video.
Yeah, I'll put links to the video and stuff.
But I would really like personally to see one of those structures. Okay, Philly, I got a cool story here because, you know, I'm in the water business myself.
Yeah.
And I'm always kind of checking in on stuff like that. And that's one thing that I always think about is water safety. In around the world. Now, we are at a luxury to be able to have it here in the States at the level that it is. But I found this on SmithsonianMag.com, and it's about Ethiopia. And it's actually, there is a man that has invented a tower called the Warka Water Tower.
I saw pictures of it.
It looks cool as hell, right?
Yeah, it looks pretty neat. I don't know how it works.
Well, it's designed to pull drinking water out of thin air.
That's what it says
yes.
in the title. Now, how does that work?
25 gallons of clean drinking water per day is what this thing can come up with.
Really? See, now that's more than enough for a family to get
yes.
by. That's enough
and
for you to
it's not mechanical.
It's enough for you to drink, wash clothes, whatever you need water for. Wash your camel.
They say it's kind of like have you ever heard of the Life Straw?
The one that a lot of backpackers carry.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what they're trying to be along those lines.
So is it pulling condensation out of the
yes.
air?
Yes.
And it's condensing it? And
yep. And kind of storing it and the whole thing. Now, here's the thing. It's a 30-foot tall vase-shaped tower. And it's actually got the Warka is actually the name of a fig tree that's native to Ethiopia.
Okay.
It looks like a piece of art, in my opinion.
It looks
like
it's got these crazy looking fingers at the top of it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It says right here that it's actually comprised of a lightweight elastic junca stalks woven in a pattern that offers stability in the face of strong wind gusts while still allowing air to flow through. A mesh net made of nylon or polypropylene, which calls to mind large Chinese lanterns, hang inside, collecting droplets of dew that form along the surface. As cold air condenses, the droplets roll down into a container at the bottom of the tower. The water in the container then passes through a tube that functions as a faucet, carrying the water to those waiting on the ground.
Man, that is impressive. Now, this is in Ethiopia, right?
Yes. Now, let me tell you this.
I was going to say, before you finish with your next sentence, does this device work anywhere on planet Earth, or does it only work in certain regions?
Well, the way it sounds, it works anywhere because it's just collecting it from the air.
Because especially if it's doing it in Ethiopia, you know what I mean? Like, if this would be not as amazing if it was in the middle of the Amazon jungle. I'd be like, well, there's water everywhere.
Or if it was right outside of Seattle and it's just raining like hell.
Exactly. Yeah. That's, you know,
you're talking about a place that's very, very dry because there is moisture in the air.
Man, so this could that's now, the picture of it, it doesn't look gigantic. Could they make, you know, that's always a talk is we're running out of fresh water on this planet.
Allegedly.
Could they construct a gigantic one of these that, say, produces 2,500 gallons a day?
I'm sure they could. I'm sure
they
could.
That sounds like
money-wise, this seems like it's more like the big wind turbines. It's better to have a whole bunch of them than one gigantic one.
Oh, I got you.
You know, a bunch of 30-footers.
Well, that's another thing. How much do these things cost? I mean, can the people, the average person in Ethiopia afford one, or are these things like $2 million a pop, and so...
I don't think it's that big a deal. I don't even think that it's actually going to cost much of anything because Water.org co-founder Matt Damon is involved in this, and so is Bill Gates.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're both really big into the whole water thing. I know Matt does a lot to help out and things, and then so does there's another fella that's also helping to – I think that they've actually put out the reinvent the toilet because of the low flows, because of the water wasted and things like that in the high-flow toilets. But there's other people getting more and more involved in this. But I'll tell you something that blew me away. They said people in this region of Ethiopia, to find clean water sometimes takes around a six-hour journey to find out.
Just to get water.
We bitch about sitting in traffic, first world problems for an hour. Or you're pissed off because your iPad won't stay charged. These poor people have got to travel six-hour journey for water that you have to have.
Yeah, you have to have.
You have to have. They said people in this region spend 40 billion hours a year.
I know this is going to sound stupid, but if I lived 6 hours from water, I probably wouldn't live 6 hours from water.
I would probably live 6 feet.
You know what I'm saying, though?
I know
like,
exactly
why would I choose to
mean.
Live someplace after? I mean, I could see a well dries up or something, but then I'm like, well, dude, I'm going to have to move.
Yeah, but also, too, I don't know anything about where they're at. I don't know what kind of maybe military turmoil it's under to maybe you can't get there and let, you know, like nobody lives there. We control the water and people have to come from 6 hours from where they live to get to it.
Maybe it's right there in the same village, but there's like a 6 hour line wait to
very
get it.
Possibly,
you know what I mean?
Very possibly. They said that it affects nearly 1 billion people in Africa alone from being able to get water. And see that these are things that we take. Okay. For those of you that don't know, folks, I work in the municipality here in the water department. And I'm a lab rat. I do a lot of quality control for our water plant that's here in this town. So I've gone to school and done it. I've done it for 10 years now. And it's one of those things that I didn't really choose the career. The career almost kind of pulled me into it. But it's things that I always look at for this water thing. And I've had to deal with people in customer service and the fact that, you know, we get called to their homes and they're pissed because there may be a line break and the guys may be working on that. And you have to go up and talk to the people at the house and they're mad because they turned on their faucet and there's no fresh water coming out of their faucet.
Yeah.
And you got to wait maybe an hour or two before, you know, we turn the valves back on by the time the flushing and the repairs have been made and all that. And people are pissed, you know, and they're like, hey, man, we're trying to get it back on. But trust me, you'll have water this evening or you'll have water in the next couple of hours or 45 minutes or whatever. Not 6 hours.
Yeah.
And you're talking about water. I mean, you've seen the water some of these people are dealing with isn't great. I mean, it's one of those ones that, I mean, you, even boiling it, you're just kind of like, ooh, what the heck's going on, you know? But this seems to be something that really, really may help everything. I mean, it's going to be something that.
So what's the game plan? They're going to start mass producing these things all over Ethiopia? Is that the game plan? Or anywhere that any third world country that has problems with water that Matt Damon and this guy are going to. Start constructing these? Is that what the game plan is?
It seems like they're going to start offering them up to a lot of remote villages is what it says that it really seems to be doing. and that the temperature, the way it happens is the difference between the temperature between nightfall and daybreak. And it says that they are proving extremely successful, even in the desert, where the temperature differs as much as 50 degrees, that they're actually been able to pull it out of the air. So to answer your question on that, it's of people wanting to know what they're going to cost. It's about $500 a tower to get set up.
Oh, that's not bad at all.
No.
Especially if you get 25 gallons of fresh water every day.
Yep.
I mean, that seems well worth it, right? And probably over time, the price will come down.
Yes. So it's, you know that once they get it, and this is just the one guy that's making it. So you know that once they get it going, that it's other people are going to get involved in it. I'm trying to find, let me look right here, but the guy's, I can't really find his first name. His last name's Vittoria. But that he says his team, he hopes to install 2 Warka towers in Ethiopia by next year and is currently searching for investors who may be interested in scaling the water harvesting technology across the region. So they're really $500 a throw, man. I mean, it seems like you could get on a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo.
Absolutely.
And you could gather up enough money to have 4 or 5 of them if people wanted to donate. Now, I hope they turn to something like that.
How about just even here where we have access to water? What if you had a garden in your backyard, you had one of these things, you got 25 gallons of fresh water you could use to irrigate your own garden?
Yeah.
And it does it for nothing. I mean, it pulls it out of the air.
Well, I mean,
and that's saying in Ethiopia, 25 gallons. I wonder if it's in a wetter climate, could it pull more? Like if you're down in Houston, you can stand outside and you'll collect water in about 5 minutes, both sweat and water. I mean, it's so humid down there, forget it.
You go to Hotlanta?
Oh, I remember one time years ago, one of my friends was a superintendent of one of the golf courses down there, one of the really nice ones where they used to have the Shell Houston Open.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
It was like 6:30 a.m. tee time, and I swear to God, it was like in August. In like 5 minutes, I was already soaking wet with sweat. I mean, I was like, I don't know how people live down here. This is ridiculous.
Why?
Yeah. Well, swampy. And the swamp ass.
That's right. And the way everybody's wanting to go green. And
that seems neat, right?
Wouldn't you like to have one here at your house?
I could see Cody Lundin with one of these.
Yes. Yeah, but I'm talking not even just for your garden. What about for your home?
Absolutely.
I mean, this is something that could really, they talk about water, you know, they want to reuse the gray water collection. You know, you want to do rainwater collection and you want to purify your own rainwater and stuff. Well, what about this?
Yeah, have a bigger one. And so say it's producing 75 gallons of fresh water every day. I mean, you could use that. And then you have your solar panels for your electricity or your wind turbines. You could be 100% self-sufficient.
Yeah. You could easily move out into the country and put all this stuff up. Yeah. Or even your own wind turbine. You have your wind turbine and your solar panels. So you got both of those. Now you got your water collection. You don't have to drill a well. This is something we're going to have to look into, the way fracking's been going here in Texas, screwing up the whole damn place. So, yeah, this is really something that really might be 100% useful, man. And I'm really glad to see that they're getting it to Ethiopia and those people are going to get some fresh water.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Did you see in Before It's News this article called Does the Lineage of Giants Still Exist?
I saw part of it, but I didn't get a chance to read any of it.
Yeah, you know how I'm always fascinated with the Giants.
Yeah.
And like I said, this is on beforeitsnews.com, and I'll post links to it. It's a small little article about giants, and it's talking about in the rainforest of San Juan Province in Peru, the giants are still occasionally viewed by locals there. They're exceedingly tall, hunchbacked, red-haired, and oftentimes seen with carrying clubs. And the author goes on to say that these are probably just extraordinary stories or legends, and where's all the physical proof? But then he goes on to say that there is physical proof, and he calls it the Holy Trinity of cryptic research, or cryptid research. There's legends, there's present-day reports, and there is physical evidence. They found numerous, you've seen them, red-haired, elongated skulls found in Peru.
Yeah.
You know, and if they didn't have all this, you might just think it was all conjecture or just BS, you know, but they do have these things. And apparently there's numerous places with ongoing sightings of giants. I always thought that this was an ancient race that was long gone. But even it goes on to say that even in the Solomon Islands, they have reports from ancient times until today of giants.
So they're still actually seeing these things.
Certain people say that they are.
Hmm.
It says that they were not only living there thousands of years ago, but are still encountered today. The islanders believe in the Guadalcanal that they live underground in an enormous cave system. And what do we know about the giants and caves? I mean, from Lovelock Cave to Death Valley, the Grand Canyon, and even in Europe, There's all types of native legends of these red-haired giants living in caves. They says in Argentina, there's a beast known as the Ucamar, and it's been reported in the forest areas, and it supposedly lives in caves.
I feel like we're going to have to head to Peru is what you're trying to tell me now. Is this another reason for us to go down there?
Well, it's a neat article. I mean,
you sure it's not them just rocking the ayahuasca or the Ibogaine and now they're seeing these giant
red-haired
people?
Absolutely could be. There was even a post by, I guess, a reader. You know, you can comment on stuff on Before It's News. And he talks about years ago, he was in Argentina and they were doing some kind of archaeological work and they found a huge bone, a gigantic femur.
Really?
Yeah. And he said, like, the military police came in and they covered it all up and they didn't let him go back. And he said that he talked to some other people that were there and they said that, oh, yeah, they knew what it was. They had a name for it. They said that they find giant skulls around there all the time.
Really?
And he said this was, you know, 15 or 20 years ago where there's not really that many reports on the internet to find out whatever happened to all this. But he's like, it's always consumed him and he always wanted to know what it was. You know, what are these Patagonian tribes of these giant red-haired
and then
giants?
The fact that it's been covered up, that's always the wildest thing, is that, you know, like, come on, man. I mean, you're talking, it's one thing to have a little speculation. It's a whole other thing to have a big pile of bones right there and a femur that's, you know, 48 inches long.
Well, and that's right. Now, is that what some of these viewings of these urine or what's the orang pandek?
Well, that's small.
Right, the orang pandek's small, right? But these native areas, these undeveloped areas, are these giants, I mean, are they giants? Are they seeing Sasquatches and they're calling them giants or vice versa? You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Love the stories of the giants and the fact that they're still seeing them.
Well, there's, you know how I am on that. There's thousands of cases here in North America alone about, you know, giants. I mean, you can go to newspaper clippings. You can go. They have bones. I mean, there's no doubt. It's not manufactured. It's real. But speaking of Sasquatch, after the break, you're going to get into us about the Minnesota Eichmer.
Yeah, well, it was one of those things. After I talked about going down to Austin and seeing it, I got several emails and messages of people wanting to know a little bit more about it or where they can go to find some more about it. So I was like, you know what? I might as well kind of give a good history of the rundown of the Minnesota Iceman after I talked about it on the last show. So I'm going to kind of get into it. And I tell you, the more of the digging, I mean, I really spent some time digging on it and I found some really interesting stuff out about it that I had no clue that I haven't found anywhere else. And I found about it. So
I can't wait.
Enjoyable. Yeah, it's going to be cool.
All right. Well, stay with us, folks. This is Expanded Perspectives.
Now at McDonald's, a McDouble is only $2.50. So you can get your gym gains on or just get lunch for only $2.50. Get more value on the under $3 menu.
Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher for delivery.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Thanks for joining us, folks. Hope you liked those last stories we covered. Cam, I'm really interested in this Minnesota Iceman because you've actually got to see it. I've never seen it. I've read about it a long time ago and saw some really crappy photos off the internet of the thing.
Yeah.
It looks like a rotted, you know, I don't know, a prune.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
what did you find out?
Well, like I said, everybody that listened last week or so, they found out, you know, they knew I'd went to Austin, went to the Museum of the Weird.
Right.
And they actually have on display the Minnesota Iceman down there. They have the original signs. They have the air conditioned or the freezer cabinet coffin that he's in. You get to go in a room where it's, you know, the locked room. You get to go in there. You get to stand and look over him like people have done since the 60s, you know, staring over here at the Minnesota Iceman.
Is it still in ice?
Yeah, still in ice, 100%. Still in ice.
Okay.
So everybody, you know, and like I said, I thought I knew, you know, enough about it to be dangerous. I wouldn't say I was any sort of a specialist, you know, in anything like that. But enough, like we've always said, enough to be dangerous. So I had got a few messages and things from people and, you know, they wanted to know a little bit more about it. So I was like, you know what? I think I'll look into it. and talk about it on the show. And then this, like I said, this just led into more and more stuff. Now, folks, I'll tell you what I saw. I'll talk about it on there. What I saw looked to be, it was male. It was, you know, roughly, I'd say 6 foot tall. So it wasn't huge.
It wasn't huge.
Like, it's not like a 9 footer. It's not like Hank, Rick Dyer's Hank. It's not nowhere that big. Its hands and its feet, nothing looked out of proportion. Nothing looked too crazy. All right. What I saw.
5 digits on each hand and stuff.
From what I could see. Yeah. The ice isn't crystal clear. You know how, you know, like when you make an ice cube, it gets white because I guess there's air in the, there's a lot of that in there. And of course, you know, and then it's old. I mean, this thing is an old creature. So I was like, okay, I think I'll get into.
Well, that was always one of my questions in the past, the Minnesota Iceman. Is this thing supposed to be a Sasquatch, or is it just probably a human being that was frozen in the ice?
Well,
you know what I'm saying? Like, what was that guy in, like, Italy, I think they found not too long ago? They had, like, a spear point still in him or something. I mean,
that's kind of what the whole Sasquatch talk never really started until much, much later.
Okay. So it is probably just a Homo sapien.
Well, they've named it. I mean, they actually named it. That's what this whole story gets a little crazy. Like I said, what I saw looked to be roughly a 6 foot primate or of the Homo gene of genus of some sort. It had, its hair was long and dark, 3 or 4 inch long hair on it. You can really see its face, you know, and the whole thing. Now, if you want to go, I kind of wrote this down on my notes, as this is kind of the official story of what people talked about when they saw it. But this is going to get into a little bit of the history. Now, the man that promoted it was traveling with it. Its name was Frank Hansen. And he had always claimed that the Iceman was discovered in a region of Siberia, and that it had actually come from like some ice flow, that it had been found over there.
So it wasn't found in Minnesota?
No. And that it was, Frank's from Minnesota. So that was the reason that all this was coming forth. But,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, I thought this thing was found in ice in Minnesota.
Now there's another part of the story too.
Okay. Go ahead.
Comes into that. But, and he said that he was simply acting as its caretaker for an anonymous owner, who Frank had claimed that, in his own words, was an eccentric California millionaire. And he had stuck by that and forever. I mean, he stuck by that whole story until his death. Frank had always said that he didn't own it, that it was somebody else's, and that he was simply
the caretaker.
The caretaker. He was traveling with it and showing it off and all this. Now, he toured all across the U.S. with it. And the really neat thing was, unlike Hank, that in 1968, Frank allowed 2 cryptozoologists to really sit down and inspect this thing. Ivan Sanderson, which Ivan Sanderson's a Scottish-born cryptozoologist.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. He had degrees in zoology, botany, and entology. So the man knew what he was looking at.
Yeah.
Also, Bernard Hivelson came to look at it. Now, he was also a cryptozoologist.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
He had a PhD in zoology. And he's considered what many consider to be the father of cryptozoology.
Cryptozoology, that's right.
Yes. So those 2 men in 1968, along with Frank Hansen, just those 3, studied it. Frank was in the room with them while they studied it. Now, after their study, it says they concluded that it was indeed a genuine creature, what they saw.
So they knew it wasn't a dummy.
They knew, exactly.
Like Rick Dyer's guy. They knew it wasn't a fake. It was.
Yes.
They knew it was a real live living creature.
Yes. And in fact, they stated that they had found putrefaction where some of the flesh had been exposed from the melting ice.
Okay.
But in 1969, Bernard wrote in an article in a Belgian scientific journal, and in the article he stated, not only suggested that it was the Iceman was a new species of Neanderthal, but that he named it. And I'm not going to be able to pronounce it properly, I'm sure, but it's Homo poingodus is its name. So he actually named it some sort of creature. So starting off right off the bat, not only did he believe it. Now, this is a man with a doctorate in cryptozoology. So not only did he believe what he looked at was real, but he went ahead and named the thing, gave it some talking. So Bernard believed most likely. Now, this is what's funny. Here's part of the other story we're talking about, that it had most likely been shot and killed in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, is what he said, which is interesting because you and I did some stories on the rock apes in the past, and they're not huge animals.
That's
the rock
true.
Apes aren't very big. So, now we're kind of leaning back towards.
The orangutan, like we talked about earlier, that's like from that area too, isn't it?
So now we're talking maybe about a 6 footer or so.
So wait a minute. So now the guy's saying He thinks it might have been shot in Vietnam, transported to Siberia where he bought it.
No. All Bernard is saying is he believed that it was shot in Vietnam, and that's all he's saying during the Vietnam War.
Okay.
Frank never once gives any inkling that this is where it came from, and I'll get into more where it comes from later. Because I have heard stories, and I'm sure the listeners have heard stories and things too. I have heard and read in places too that that Frank allegedly had shot it, you know, back in the day, and then he went and got it and brought it, and it was shot up in Minnesota, in the woods of Minnesota.
Yeah, I think that's what I heard.
Well, I found out more of this whole thing. So
it was the original Justin Smirnoff.
Yeah, exactly. So this is, if that wasn't crazy enough, here's where it starts getting a little crazier.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
So, okay, like I said, in 69, this information comes out. Well, due to it being given the name Homo, so it's human now.
Right.
Or at least a human branch from Bernard's article that, I guess you could say our wonderful and terrific FBI, wonderful and terrific. I love the U.S. government. I love the FBI. I love the NSA. Anybody listening, don't come over to my house or nothing like that.
Oh, they're listening.
But the FBI started getting involved because they were under the belief that it could simply be maybe a homeless man. It could simply be a less developed man that was the victim of a murder and that he's traveling the country with its corpse. With it, you know, so the victim, and that Hansen's just dragging it around, making money off of it. So around this time is when he took it to Canada to make a little run with it up there. Well, and on the way back, crossing into the U.S., the Canadian officials detained it, fearing that it was also a body. It was a cadaver. And they were going to test it. They were going to actually, you know, cut into it, pull a plug out of it. Hansen's freaking. You can't do that. You can't do that. Then they said, okay, well, we'll x-ray it. And Hansen had talked to Bernard at the time, and he was trying to get their help. And he was like, they can't x-ray it. They can't do anything, which I find strange that I guess. If it's fake at this time, if it's a rubber suit, why wouldn't you say, hey, look, guys, this thing ain't real. Now, Hansen had paperwork on it and the whole thing. But why wouldn't you just go look in secrecy? This thing ain't real, guys. Y'all can cut a little piece out of it right here. Don't tear it up, you know, please.
Or that, exactly. Or like, look, I don't want you to cut it up and destroy it because I'm saving it. But I don't mind if you x-ray it. That's not going to hurt it.
If you x-ray it, there's no bones in it. It's just a rubber suit. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
If that's what it is, hey, it's just a rubber suit. Don't release it. Just say, okay, we looked at it and that's it, you know, and let's get this whole thing worked out. But Hansen flipped. You know, he's like, don't touch it. Don't x-ray it. Don't do nothing. It's none of your stuff. Well, believing that the officials were working with the FBI, he actually got a U.S. senator, Mr. Walter Mondale, is who
really?
It was, yes, to help him get it back. And they had to release it back to him. So they released it back to Hansen without studying it out, doing anything, and he got it back. And it was right after that is when he pulled it from public view for a little while. Well, he claimed that he was told to do all this by the California owner. But it wasn't long after that Hansen returned with a new Iceman for exhibit, okay? So that's when you start getting into these stories of people coming to see it the second time, and they're like, that's not what I saw. You know, the first time looked like this, the second time looks like that.
Right.
Well, it was around the time of the second appearance or the reappearance of the Iceman that the Smithsonian got involved, and they contacted a primatologist named John Napier and asked him to investigate it under the official orders of the Smithsonian. So when the, in quotations, new Iceman reappeared, Napier, along with the Smithsonian, went after some preliminary investigations so they could kind of get an idea of what it was.
Right.
And they had claimed that in 1967, Frank got from a California company, or a California company out there, to create a latex version of the Iceman. And that it was simply repositioned and refroze, and as to appear different when they brought it out. So it was they claimed the Smithsonian
they made a recreation.
Well, no, the Smithsonian claims that it was fake from the start, and all he did was thaw it out, reposition it, change it up a little bit, refreeze it, and say it's a whole different Iceman. Now that's what they were claiming. Okay.
Okay.
They also believe that it was nothing more than anything fake. That it was nothing that they, you know, every bit of it was made just to make money off of, kind of like the Hank, the Rick Dyer special. But it gets even wilder than that. Now, in 1982, in Fate magazine, matter of fact, in the March of 82 issue, they ran a piece called The Iceman Goeth. And in that, they spoke to a man named Howard Bell. Okay. Howard Bell made models for Disneyland. Now, he had passed away. They'd spoke to his widow, and she had claimed that he had made the Iceman in his Torrance, California studio. And her claim was, and here's the quote, says, "The man who commissioned it said he was going to encase it nice and pass it off, I think, as a prehistoric man," end quote. And it says, now, okay, now Howard's son, Kenneth, now Kenneth's a lawyer now, but Kenneth said he helped his dad build the thing and claimed that the skin was nothing more than half-inch rubber latex and that it was all molded up to an artist's conceptual drawing.
Huh.
Is even so much to make it look like it had a broken arm and a bashed-in skull.
Wow.
So, like I said, now it gets a little bit deeper. Well, there's a great book out there, and the book is called The Sasquatch in Minnesota by Mike Quast, okay? And in July of 89, and now he's a cryptozoologist and he's a researcher, and in July of 89, he got to interview Frank Hansen at his ranch, and he came up with a bunch of information from it. And this is straight from the book, okay? This is straight from Mike's book. This is what Mike states. It says, according to Hansen, what does not appear in either scientist's report is just how they became convinced the Iceman was real. To get the best possible view of it, they had hung bright lights over the glass under which it lay. Now, I've seen this. You know, I've seen the glass. I know in my mind, I'm picturing right along of what's going on.
You know exactly what it looks like.
And while Hansen was away from them for a moment, one of them placed one of the hot lights directly on top of the ice-cold glass, and it shattered. And a pungent odor like that of rotting flesh rose from the ice. This convinced them that it was an actual corpse, freshly killed, lay before them. Hansen will never forget what the distinguished scientist said when he reminded them of their promise not to publicize the story at that point. And this is what they said. "We are scientists first and gentlemen second."
Huh.
So they were going to run with it. They took it and run with it instantly. He didn't want them to tell it was even real then.
Right.
You know, he's just touring with it. He don't want them to know it's real because he knew it would get taken away from him.
Right.
Now, Ivan Sanderson reports, and his even refers to him saying this, and it says, "The corpse or whatever it is rotting. This could be detected by a strong stench typical of rotting mammalian flesh, excluding from one of the corners of the insulation in the coffin. Whatever this corpse may be, it would seem to include flesh of some kind." Now, him talking about that leak in the corner of the coffin,
right.
You can see that leak in the corner of the coffin if you go to Austin to the Museum of the Weird and see it, because it's there. It was pointed out to us. You go around to the, and you can see where it's almost like they've taken the wood graining stickers that look like on pool tables and on the top of old stuff like that.
Yes.
That's what some of that stuff looks like that's on it. And down in the bottom corner of it, some of that is stained. Some of that wood is stained, and you can tell it's something has drained out of right there, like it had gone to thaw out. Well, that's just something funny to me that I had seen that, ask him about it, and then now it's in paperwork. It's in Mike's book as he talks about it. All right. Now, here's a little funny thing, I guess, before we get off the subject of the Minnesota Iceman, was a lot of people, like we said, have toured and looked at it, and there's a lot of people in Austin that have talked about it, and they even tell stories of people that have come and seen it when they were kids and then come see it now in Austin. They're like, "Yeah, that's what I saw. That's what I saw." And then there's some older people that have come to see it, and like, "I saw it when I was a kid, and that's not what I did. That's not what I'm looking at. What you have isn't what I saw as a child." Now, of course, that can be as a child. You know, you may embellish it in your mind, things like that.
Well, there's movies I've seen as a child that I loved, and you watch them now as an adult, and you're like, "Golly, this is terrible.
It's horrible.
Why did I love this movie so much?"
Most of all, the Van Damme and Steven Seagal movies are those movies.
Yeah. I used to think those were really awesome when I was younger. I loved it.
Van Damme's a great guy.
Oh, yeah.
Steven Seagal's a monster. You know, he taught Anderson Silva the front kick. But anyway, I'm getting off topic. But and they even talk about some of this stuff. So while you're down there in Austin, and which, like I said, if you're interested in crypto at all, you need to go down there. You need to go see the Minnesota Iceman. It's part of history. Well, getting back into this, many people believed that this alleged California owner was a real person. And some believe, like I said, that Frank shot and killed the creature himself in the woods of Minnesota. And, you know, but what's funny is Frank, in all the stories and all the books and all the things, he always referred to this California owner, this guy in California, this private owner. Even up until his death, he always referred to it as the owner. Now, when they purchased the Minnesota Iceman, it didn't come from Frank and his family. They had not owned it for about 10 years whenever they purchased it, and it got shipped to Austin. So they had not had it for a long time. But this mystery owner, the story goes, is in 1967 at an Arizona State Fair. Frank met the man, and this guy was talking to Frank, and one thing led to another. Now, Frank used to travel with a lot of antique tractors. That was one thing that used to go with him with the Iceman, and I think that's what he traveled. He was an antique tractor collector.
Right.
But that Frank always said that the man was connected in the entertainment industry and had a very recognizable name. That's the reason he wouldn't tell anybody. Now, the story goes as this, that the man that it was, this is the story that I've read, a part of it, was that it was found by some Chinese fishing trollers floating in ice, and that they pulled it aboard their ship, and that they brought it to Hong Kong. And at Hong Kong,
so this
it
was in the ocean.
It was in the ocean, like it had broke off.
Holy cow.
And that in Hong Kong, they inspected it, cut some of the ice down. They got in contact with this Californian man that they speak of. And knowing that he was involved in crypto things, he came to check it out. He came to check it out, but also being
George Takei,
also being extremely a very religious person, that it went against his belief in that Bible had created, you know, the creation story in the Bible, because this proved to be much, much older and much more like the missing link. So he went ahead and bought it, but that he had kept it in storage and had tried to find, you know, I guess somebody maybe that was like-minded, something like that. And I guess that's how, by chance, he bumped into Frank, and then him and Frank. Now, like I said, this is all hearsay. This is all things that you read. You don't know. Frank's since passed. This man in Hollywood has since passed. But that maybe they kind of hit it off. And
Did it ever say who that?
I'm getting to it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it, the, like I said, there's a lot of theory about it. That, like I said, he hit it off. He gave it to somebody, and that Frank took it and toured around with it. Well, if you, anybody that does any serious reading about Tom Slick, the man that went to Nepal and helped smuggle the Yeti hand out.
Yeah.
Jimmy Stewart was the man that helped him smuggle that out.
I've heard that he had an interest in stuff like that.
They believe it's Jimmy Stewart that helped get this whole Iceman thing out. And that was being said. There is an article one time that somebody had spoke to Frank on the phone. This is a few years after Jimmy had passed away and not too long before Frank passed away. And they mentioned it to Frank. And they said, Frank, we think it's Jimmy Stewart. Because Frank would never say. And they said there was a long pause on the phone. He said, I guess we'll never know since he's already gone.
Yeah.
And that his wife actually, somebody had actually contacted Frank's wife and son both, of course, but contacted his wife. And she said, whoever that person was, Frank took it to his grave. Because she said, I don't know. But she said, Frank never cared about cryptozoology until he got involved with that. And Frank and his wife went and met Bob Gimlin in the 60s after he filmed that.
Right.
So that's kind of where the story goes. If you like it and you like the story and you like this, do yourself a solid. Order that book. Find that book, The Sasquatch in Minnesota by Mike Quest. Do yourself a solid. Go down to Austin. Check it out. Look at it. This is one of those stories that there's a lot more involved in it. I mean, you just mentioned this whole thing.
I never heard that whole explained story. I always heard that the guy found it or something or shot it in Minnesota, shot it, and then toured the U.S. with the thing. That's what I heard.
The story that I had heard was that it was shot in the back of the head. That
right, like it had even put its hand up.
Yes.
And I think a bullet went through its wrist and then went into its head. It was like a .357 or something.
Well, it was the story I had heard was it had been shot in the back of the head, like running away or so like that. And that Frank had his dog with him, and they were out in the woods. And they were out in the woods, and that he left it there, and it snowed hard that night. And he didn't know what it was. He thought it was a hairy person, and he split. And then it wasn't till later he came back, like a few days later, and gathered it up, brought it back home, put it in the freezer and froze it, and then decided to do this and kind of set it out there and tour with it. Then, like I said, I hear this story that it's comes from Siberia, you know, and Frank tells that. And then you hear this story that it actually could have possibly been found by a Chinese fishing troller and that they pulled it up.
Man, so that's wild.
It may, if nothing else, it makes for a great story.
Absolutely.
But if you really, this is one of those things that I, as I sat there and I read and researched and looked into this and I kind of boiled it down, I was like, you know what? This seems the kind of story that you would build in Hollywood and you would build to protect somebody. Does that, you know, if that makes sense, is you would want to try to lay out as many fingers as you could, kind of like disinformation, to help hide some of the real story, but that there is shards of truth in the original story.
Yeah.
So I'm fascinated with it, but it makes sense to me. Like I said,
I want to see
know the, when you know the history.
And of course, people are going to ask, why didn't you take pictures? They don't allow photography.
Well, you see, there's pictures. If you go on our Facebook page or our Twitter page and things, there's pictures posted of me in the room. And you can see part of the box that I'm beside.
Yeah.
You can see the signs. That's all they'll allow you to do. And it's per Frank Hansen's original request, which is strange to me. I understand people not wanting to take photos of it. You can see some photos online people have taken. Frank's had his picture made with it before. Per the original request of Frank Hansen was show the Iceman a little respect. Don't take a picture of his body. And if it was a rubber suit, and why would you care? If you were getting money for it and it was simply a rubber suit, I understand you're trying to pass it off as being real. And maybe somebody would look at it and go, oh, I don't need to go see it now because I've seen a photograph of it, you know, and the whole thing. And it goes back into the whole Rick Dyer deal. I saw photographs of Hank, but still didn't mean I wouldn't pay my $10 to go see it, you know,
right,
because I've went and seen the Iceman. I would go see Hank now, you know, knowing that it's fake. I'd start to go see it and be like, okay, you know, now I've seen it. But I don't know, just something about this story alone. And I don't know if it's because it's not brand new, if it's because it's old and I'm slightly nostalgic as I get older. Something about this story really makes me feel like there was a real body at one time.
Yeah.
And because of all the trouble that was coming of it, they got rid of that body.
Or it went to some private collection.
Exactly. And then he had something else he brought out and displayed as it and all that.
Maybe the original owner said, hey, you know, you've been touring around with that. I kind of really want it back. I want it back, but I'll allow you to make a recreation and tour with that, but I want the original back in my vault.
And he may have made the recreation and give it to Frank and took the original and give Frank that and let him do it, you know, to build the whole thing up. But it almost feels like, and it's simply off the stories of people that, and I don't mean children, I mean people that had seen it that were our age when they saw it, and when they were much, much older, then they come back and saw it again, and they were like, that's not what was in the box when I was there.
Yeah.
I've heard that from many accounts.
I have too. So that's interesting.
It really does feel to me like this is one of those stories that we're never going to get to the bottom of, but that there's a lot more to it than just a rubber suit and a freezer.
Yeah. Sounds like more. It. Yeah.
So like I said, do that's yourselves cool. a solid. Get the book.
Next time I go to Austin, I'm definitely going there.
We'll go. We'll run down there and we'll go down there and check that out. And I'm going to take you and put you in the float tank.
Cool, man.
What do you think? It was pretty cool, right?
Yeah, that's awesome.
Awesome, awesome. I hope y'all enjoyed it, folks. I really did. Stick around because we're going to get back with a little gunplay and aliens involved there at Fort Penis. So make sure to stay with us. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
All right, man, we are going to jump back into this article right here. Kyle, you know, I'm really into this military and the aliens and all this stuff. And now you got some teaser story you've been dangling over my head like a carrot for the last 4 or 5 days. So what have you got?
Yeah, this is pretty interesting. It's called an alien being shot dead by military police.
Not just shot.
No, they killed it.
Dead.
Yep, they killed it. This is off of UFOcasebook.com.
Are they touring with him in a freezer?
No, they don't have. There's no sign of the body.
Damn it.
I don't know if you've ever heard of this story.
No, actually, I have not.
Okay. And this takes place January 18th, 1978, Fort Dix and McGuire Air Force Base. Okay. Apparently, these two bases butt up to each other, and they're in New Jersey. Okay.
Leave it to you to start dragging out more New Jersey stories.
Well, it just happens that way. You know, I don't aim for it to come out that way. It says here that during the early mornings of January 18th, 1978, multiple UFOs were sighted flying over Fort Dix and McGuire Air Force Base and two adjacent military bases. Shortly afterwards, Air Force Security Patrol was ordered to the back gate of McGuire Air Force Base to allow the entry to New Jersey State Police, who were searching for something. Crazy, right?
Yeah.
It says one of the airmen on duty was Sergeant Jeff Morse, which is a pseudonym to protect him. And it says the state trooper told Morse that a Fort Dix military police was pursuing a low-flying object that had hovered over his car. Then a small being with a large head and slender body appeared in front of his car. The MP had panicked and shot the alien several times with a .45 automatic.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. Then the being had fled over the fence between the two bases before falling and dying on a deserted runway. Says Morris and his colleagues found the body lying on the runway, and as they followed routine procedures, they roped off the area as a crime scene before other Blue Beret forces took over. Morris was relegated to a backup role, but he could see from a slight distance what was happening. It says later that day, a team from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base arrived in a C-141 cargo aircraft, crated and removed the body. It says 2 days later, Morse and other participants were taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, where they underwent intimidating interrogation and were again warned not to talk about the incident. He said, they told me about my duty. They told me to keep my mouth shut. I signed a form that is supposed to bind me for life. Shortly after returning to McGuire Air Force Base, Morse was debriefed by his commanding officer, a lieutenant colonel, also name unknown, or not unknown, but not named here. And he said he wanted to hear no more about this incident. Shortly thereafter, each of the airmen who were involved in this transaction were separated and moved to different bases overseas. Morse himself was removed and transported to Okinawa. It's crazy, right? It says the author of this article has met with Morris face-to-face several times, talked with him on the telephone and other numerous times, and considers him to be a completely credible source. He has cooperated fully, answering all questions to the best of his ability, and agreeing to meet and talk with various colleagues. He has even given a formal deposition on the incident in the presence of several witnesses and was subject to questioning on specific details. As a direct consequence of innocently being in the wrong place at the wrong time, Morse has been harassed and threatened, his reputation defamed to the point that he's had difficulty finding employment. Another one of the witnesses to this extraordinary event was a man named George Filer. He was a major in the U.S. military, U.S. Air Force, and he's now retired, who was also stationed at McGuire Air Force Base in 1978, serving as an intelligence officer. One of his duties on the base was briefing the other generals about the activities going on there. And I found a short interview on YouTube of George Filer. I'm going to play that for you now. Now, it's a little hissy. It's a recording. I didn't do the recording. It was like that on YouTube. And I've edited it up, so if it sounds a little chopped up, it is, because the full interview is like 25 minutes long.
I got you.
And I'll put that in the link so you can watch the entire video. But go ahead and give this a listen.
My name is George A. Filer III. I don't normally use the third. I was in the U.S. Air Force, and my final rank was major. Well, I was normally, like I mentioned, a briefing officer, and I would come to work 4 o'clock or so in the morning. And on the morning of January 18th, 1978, I drove through the main gate at McGuire, and I noticed that there was red lights out on the runway, and that probably something was going on out on the runways there because of all the red lights and, you know, like police cars and fire trucks and so on. And this particular morning when I went into the command post, I was met by the head of the command post, and he said that it's been a very exciting evening, that we've had UFOs in the, you know, over the McGuire all night, and that one had apparently landed or possibly crashed at Fort Dix, and that when a military policeman came upon the alien, that he had pulled out a gun and shot them. And I said, you know, a foreigner, like, you know, an alien. I was a little bit confused by him saying alien. He says, no, an alien from outer space. He was very specific about the fact that an alien from outer space had been shot at Fort Dix, and that it had run away after being wounded and headed for McGuire. Now, McGuire and Fort Dix just have a fence between them, and this alien supposedly climbed the fence or went under it or whatever and got to McGuire and died out on the end of the runway. I talked to one of the security policemen who claims to have been out there, and he indicated that he essentially saw a small body that, you know, could have been like a child, but it seemed to have a larger than normal head. The way it's been kept secret to a big extent is the fact of through ridicule. If it always had been just top secret, I think most of the world would know about it tonight. But they put in a kind of a ridicule factor, which made people, you'll hear somebody telling a story like this, they'll say, well, he must be crazy that he believes in UFOs. But they brought this out when anyone saw anything. You know, there'd be two people, we'll say one has funny hair and looks wild and so on, and the guy standing next to him is a police officer. Well, they always interviewed the wild guy and never put the police officer on the screen. My experience has been an awful lot of policemen have seen these, an awful lot of FBI have seen these, an awful lot of military has seen it, and he might be having the, like, at times I used to carry nuclear weapons. And in other words, I was mentally fit to carry nuclear weapons, but I'm not mentally fit if I see a UFO. Well, this criticism and this ridicule has, I think, done more to keep the story coming out than almost anything else.
See, so I like that. I like that story. I like how even at the end he talks about how people have always... The government almost wanted to discredit him because they say, you know, his story wasn't good enough, or his testimony wasn't reliable. He's like, well, I was reliable enough to take care of nuclear weapons, but now I'm not credible when it comes to me seeing a UFO.
It's the same thing we've always discussed, is if they can't really disprove what you've seen or what you've dealt with, and they try to go after your credibility.
That's exactly right.
And that's what they're going after.
And ridicule, like you said, that's one of their tactics, is using ridicule.
Yeah.
He said, if there's two people, I like how he talks about, if there's two people that see a UFO when these reporters go and there's a policeman or a guy with crazy hair, they always interview the guy with crazy hair. They never interview anybody credible. Yeah. It's almost like that when you see, like, when the space shuttle blew over Texas.
Yeah.
And they pulled some backwoods people out for television for those interviews.
Yeah, it's almost like that way they can brush it off if it's not really what they want to hear.
Yeah, if that's
you can be like, yeah, I don't really think. I like the fact that he was like, alien. What are you talking about? They shot an alien. Yeah. And they're like, no, extraterrestrial. He's like, whoa, what?
Yeah, he thought it meant like a foreigner.
Yeah, he's like, he can't just be shooting people. It's
interesting story, right?
Well, it's stories like that that really get you to thinking. It really gets you to be like, oh, man, I mean, what is going on?
Yeah, I never even heard of this story until this week. You know, I got on YouTube, and you start going from story to story to story, and you stumbled on it, and I was like, ooh, this is good.
Then you start doing more research, and you start digging into stuff, then you're just like,
Yeah. So I'll put the link to the whole interview up. I suggest anybody, if you're really interested in it, to go watch it. It's pretty neat.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to have to just go do a little research and reading on it my own. That's a great story, man.
Yeah, that's pretty neat, man. Well, folks, I think the show's just about over. You got anything for us, Cam?
No, man. I'm just having a great time, the whole deal, and I'm glad everybody's sticking around and having a good time with us.
Me too. If you're new to the show, don't forget you can follow us on our website, www.expandedperspectives.com. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter. You know the deal.
Instagram. I got the Instagram up and rocking.
That's right. We got a Pinterest now and a Tumblr. We got everything. I don't know how to work half that stuff.
We're going to figure it out. We're going to get through it. But yeah, you can find us Facebook, Pinterest, Tumblr, Instagram, Twitter. You can go listen to us on Stitcher. You can listen to us on iTunes.
I even added some share buttons at the bottom of all our posts in case people want to share it. So yeah. I suggest you do that. Please write and review. Write and review us on iTunes or Stitcher or anywhere else like that. It helps the show out.
Oh, it helps us out a lot. Yeah, if you just throw some reviews up for us. It helps so much.
And along with writing a review for us, if you want to leave a voicemail, I think me and Cam are about to implement a new voicemail on our website, and you'll see it, and I'll give more mention to it and the actual number on air when we get that set up. But you'll be able to call in, and if you have a story and you don't feel like emailing the story, you can verbally tell us your story, and we might even play it on the show.
Yeah.
You know, try to keep it clean. I mean, we're not against cursing. We do it all the time, but, you know, try to keep it as clean as possible. Also, if you want to just tell us how much you like the show and you would like to do like an audio commercial for why others should listen, you know, you might find yourself played during one of our breaks.
Yeah. I think, I imagine it's going to be coming this week, so y'all can look at it on Twitter, or look for it on Twitter, look for it on Facebook and things like that. But I would imagine by the next episode, we're probably going to
have it all rocking.
So, and we've got some more things in the works. So yeah, we're going to, once we get this up and rocking in a few weeks, we're going to let the cat out of the bag. So get ready. We got some fun stuff coming.
Well, don't work too hard this week. And I guess we will see you next Monday.
Yeah. Everybody have a good, safe week. Tell somebody you love them, give them a hug, and y'all stay safe. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.